we were just gaga-ing over Carol's wonderful job, if you weren't there. It was really just amazing. And so I recorded it, and I've done two things. I've put the recording up on my website, if you want to listen to it for free. It's jgsparks.net/spiritinplace. Or if you want to buy it, I've made copies, and I'll turn the money over to the Friends of Jung. I thought $15 for two sounded like a fair price. So if you want to buy it, you can play these on your CD player. The other you have to listen to on your computer. So if you want it, it's 2 for $15. Let me know. If you're writing a check, make it out to the Friends of Jung.
And those sheets, I wonder if she still has some of those sheets left. Would be nice for them to have with that.
Yeah, no, I gave, if you, maybe I'll mention that too. Well, if you go to the website, there's a link to her website.
Yeah.
Are all of her paintings on
there? All of her paintings are on her website.
Well, yeah. I've also got her website on the Friends of Jung.
I did, okay. And I also put the website on this one CD package. I'll give it to you if you just want to know it anyway. It's just Carol Spicuzza, www.carolspicuzza, carolspicuzza.com.
What dates are we doing after December?
Well, I haven't gotten that far yet. Let's see, we'll miss the 30th, obviously. And then we'll pick up 4 weeks after
the 16th.
The 16th, so it'll be able, I'll make up a new schedule.
I looked about what, 13th or
15th? Probably 13th, yeah. We generally skip one at Christmas or Thanksgiving, depending. And then we don't ever skip 1 or 3 weeks. We always go 2 or 4 weeks. So it'll be 2 weeks after the 30th. But here, feel free to call them if you want, Patty. Here's a setup.
Okay.
How can
you just...
No, if it's for them, don't worry about it.
Well, no, I'll give it because that's... Yeah.
Well, it goes to the Friends of Jung, so it's a donation
right,
to the Friends of Jung.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, so we don't have any dates. So you're saying we'll meet 2 weeks after the December 16th, 2 weeks after the first of the year?
2 weeks after the 30th or whatever it is.
Okay.
And then we'll get back on a...
that would be the 13th of January.
13th of January. So we'll start the 13th, and we'll go, again, every other week. I will try to make up a schedule for you.
Okay.
Every other week, and if there's any holidays in there, I'll try to figure that out. Well,
okay.
Easter, that conflicts. So. Valentine's Day.
Valentine's Day. I'm just guessing.
Oh.
I'm just being provoked.
Oh.
No. Well, we're not doing 30th of December. Right.
And,
last one's December 16th.
Well, that's something else.
Then January 13th.
Oh, and I hope we get, I hope she's coming. Actually, join me.
The rest of the
I made you a compliment.
I know, we're going to have to vote him in.
Yeah. You said no class on the 16th of December.
No class. We will have class on the 16th.
Oh, we will have class.
We will have class on the 16th. We will not have class on the 30th.
Okay.
We'll pick up then the 13th of January. We'll go every other week.
Okay.
And I hope we can get done by the spring, by May, I hope. I think you'll see we do pick up a little speed because we may not pick up any speed.
I've heard that before.
In my fondest dreams, we'll pick up speed. Who's the book seller?
Carolyn Bailey.
Carolyn, do you see her?
Mm-hmm.
That's right. I'll send her an email about these things.
About having them.
Yeah, I'll announce, because I'm speaking, I'll announce it that we've got them.
Okay,
and,
great.
Give them to her and she can sell.
Yeah. It's up and running at this point. Oh, I bet she's not.
Oh, is she really?
Yeah. Who is? But she's going to still keep doing this. I'll just mention it to her because I will see that you've got the. And the other thing that I would do is bring get some of those pictures from Carol, or that sheet that somebody made, and have one with those.
Okay, I'll tell Carol.
Bye-bye.
Good idea. I wouldn't have thought of that. Why not? Yeah.
That's a good idea.
With all the pictures?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, that might be a real problem for this picture, because she could bring the...
Slides.
Slides. She did it once before, and she did slides.
Yeah, and she had that as a...
Mm-hmm.
We'll do that. A lot of people didn't get to see it. We got a couple of people joined from there.
Oh, really?
Good. This is how we do it.
Yeah.
Just reach out, and each time you get a couple more, it's all...
I asked them how they heard about it, and they said they were presentation.
Super.
Your opening of that was fabulous, Gary, and I can tell my husband, I said, you have to just, if you want to sort of know what it is I love, you need to listen to this. So I, but I got a real grainy tape, and it was really hard to hear, so I'm so delighted that you did this.
Mm-hmm.
Because I thought you just gave a really wonderful synopsis for the unschooled.
Yeah.
And those of us that are schooled, really.
I was happy to do it.
Yeah, can't hear it enough, that's right.
Quick review. Judge appeared, the image of the judge appeared in the visions, referenced by the seven stars, which referred to the seven candlesticks of the apocalyptic Christ, which referred to the seven eyes of Yahweh from Zechariah, which meant that an image reminiscent of Yahweh showed up in the visions, which meant that the importance of discriminating clarity is being emphasized in the visions. We talked about the image of multiplicity in the dove as actually a regression, because what this set of visions is aiming for is to create a new individual standpoint, a new point of view. And because it was too hot to handle, he comes in and he judges it. That has a positive aspect, but it also has a negative aspect. And then he falls back into one of the community of the believers who has seen Christ. So the thing doesn't move forward. On page 239, we talked about the fact that he identified the new attitude that was coming with Christ, which again is simply a fallback into the old theology. An image we spent quite a bit of time on, and it has a couple its place here is important for a couple of reasons. One is that the seven stars led to a whitening.
Led to what?
A whitening. And the whitening was a premature clarity. So that, again, we have an image of regression. That led us into a rather long detour, but I felt it was very important to understand what the nature of this process we're talking about symbolically looks like behaviorally. This is really a metaphor for a cycle of predictable, experiential, and behavioral series of emotional events, which we really call the healing process. So you can call this the anatomy of the healing process. What is special about this version is that it comes in through the body, and it announces the big picture of your fate. That's why it's Sophia. But again, remember, all of this talk we're doing is really an attempt to give us a roadmap for the healing process and its series of sequences and how it looks and how it goes right and how it can go wrong, and for us to be able to recognize when it's going right and when it's going wrong. We talked about a color sequence, black, white, yellow, black, white, red, yellow, sorry, black, white, red, yellow. And we've seen the images of blackness that start off these texts, and that has to do with the fact that the beginning of growth starts in darkness. Depression, despair, something has gone wrong. And if it hasn't gone wrong outwardly, it goes wrong inwardly. And in trying to understand that, you come to clarity. That's the whiting. And then that clarity, however, is only mental. It's important that it's mental. It's important that you understand. But if you only understand, then you also stay stuck. So it has to become an emotional reality, and that's the red. And as you then carry that experience through the white to the red, the unconscious becomes generative. This is Jung's big hypothesis. The unconscious actually solves the problem for you by giving you an image of the redeemed state, the new attitude, the new behavior, the new possibility. And that is symbolized by the yellow or the gold. And in that state, in that new thing is also at the same time a unified, requires offers you the opportunity of being a unified human being. Because that new state will require all of you that's available to you at the moment for its being carried out. And I mentioned that I would bring along a dream of Pali's to give you an idea how this looks. And let's spend just a little bit of time on that. So I don't think you can have too many examples of this stuff. Now, of course, Pali does the first part right, but he messes up in the second part as well. Eventually see. So this is from a letter. This is from, I think it's 1951. He wrote von Franz the following in a letter. I have been going through a lot for the last week, even though outwardly nothing has happened. At the beginning of last week, I had a very strong depression, during which time I felt like I was pursued by a nightmare. This consisted in the obsession that somewhere there either is or was an absolutely perfect being. Out of pure presumption, he invented time and terrible suffering in it, into which he threw many living beings for no other reason than to be seen and praised, and for the ones thus cast down to be able to climb back up to him, kind of a Sisyphus image. It was a nightmare of absolute futility from which I was not able to free myself for a considerable time. So he's saying he got depressed, and then he got obsessed with this idea that life's meaningless and that God's really playing a cruel trick on us, and he couldn't get rid of the idea. But he stayed with it, and then he had this dream. Staying with it, of course, that's the important point. And then the emotion, as you'll see, turns into a dream image. I am on a ship, and a very strong storm is raging. See, that's the emotional upset. On the outboard of the ship stands the stranger as a large, dark man. Now, the stranger is a regular figure in one of his dreams. I won't go into it here, but it's an unknown man. He is roping up and making arrangements to jump in the stormy sea. I at first think this is just sport, but he calls to me that he wants to retrieve a person out of the sea. So you see how the unconscious is showing him something can come out of this stormy emotional state. He does not say whether this person is a man or a woman. Then completing his preparation, he jumps into the ocean, and I don't see him any longer. I then go into a large room in the ship, a kind of salon or sitting room. I see that a sort of official meeting is taking place there in order to choose a new professor. See, that's the new image. The dream is trying to announce to him new things to talk about in his lectures. The result of the vote, which I am able to hear through the tumult of voices, is a man named Peter Strom. He enters and has a completely misshapen figure, in particular an oddly flattened head and all horizontal horizontal dimensions are sternally elongated. He has certain features of the dark man who jumped into the water. He goes from the left, you enter from the left door, to a kind of ramp or stage until he is completely on the right. He walks back in the direction he came from until he's in the middle of the stage where he remains standing. There I see that he has cleaved in two, though not completely. In the front, he is a dark man, but in the back, a very beautifully bright woman shines through quite distinctly. The two are very similar, like siblings, still connected together in the middle of their bodies, so that they can move only with difficulty like Siamese twins. They are not a hermaphrodite. Rather, there are clearly two persons with separate legs, and in particular with separate heads. The earlier flattened figure has divided in two, and now there are two fully formed heads, a female and a male. Well, for our purposes, the most important thing is how that storm leads to, you could say, the death and rebirth of this figure who jumps in the water. So that would be the part of Pali who is being asked to transform through these depressions and through these obsessions. And the clearest specific indicator is that a new professor is being chosen. And that would be the new teaching possibilities that the unconscious wishes him to assume. Now, the interpreter goes on quite a bit on this figure of Peter Strom. Strom in German means stream. And Peter, of course, in Latin means rock. So the interpreter takes that as a union of opposites, see, the synthesis that we've been talking about. What he's getting is a new strength and a new fluidity. And that would be the strength to carry this new professorship and the softness to receive new ideas, or the flowing capacity to receive these new ideas. So that's an example of how the dream came out of a depression. By maintaining this attitude towards the tension, towards the unhappiness, towards the darkness, then the unconscious becomes generative. The tragedy in Pali's life is, unfortunately, he would never take these things up. He actually never really did give these lectures. And that's the second part of the process. First, you have to endure the storm, and we've talked about that storm throughout this text in many different ways. You have to endure it until you get the image. And then you get the image, and then you get the challenge to put that image into reality. It is asking, and we'll see that come up in our text in a moment, it is asking for behavior change. All of these experiences are asking for behavior change. We just don't think you make behavior changes by deciding to make behavior changes. We think you make behavior changes by getting a new image of who you are, and then putting that new person into being through a change of behavior. So there's an example of the storm and the image and the announcement.
Gary, you lost me there at the end. I thought what you said there at the end is how we think about it instead of how it actually unfolds. Just repeat what you said.
Well, I was just sort of contrasting that we're just not interested in behavior change. We're interested in helping people become new people. And you get an image of the new person. See, that Peter Strom is the new him. The new professor is the new him. I mean, it's that black and white sometimes. And that is asking for the behavior change. The behavior change follows on the new image. And without that new sense of selfhood, I think Jung would say, I would say, that the behavior change is meaningless. We're not just talking about behavior change. We're talking about becoming the person you were meant to be. And our hypothesis is Pali was meant to become this Peter Strom. This is in his stars from wherever.
So he chose not to?
He chose not to.
And then died?
And died. He died 7 years after his dream.
Did he die prematurely?
Yeah, he's 58.
Okay. So maybe he always thought he would get to this.
That's a very complicated question. A little bit out of our scope. exactly what was going on and why it didn't work, I think, is a study in itself.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But in any case, either through his mistake or von Strauss's mistake or Jung's mistake, I'm not sure. It didn't happen. I think we have to make him take a lot of responsibility. But this is what I'm working on at the moment, so I'll keep you posted on where I think it all goes. But I just want to, I want to keep giving you examples. Remember the therapist with the candle penis, candle phallus, and the light. Where you are cooking in something, and by maintaining the right attitude, that cooking generates something that has never been before. That's what we mean by the unconscious being creative. And this I feel, is really the source of creativity. It's something that has never been generated before. This is a project I'm working on. I hopefully I'll have it done maybe by summer. It might be something we could take on. There are about 40 dreams in the book. And what he's being asked to do is to lecture, not in this dream, but in other dreams, lecture on the relationship between alchemy, China, and quantum physics. It's incredible that the unconscious would bring this stuff up. I mean, he had no connection with China, other than being somewhat fascinated. This was, of course, way before the Orient became popular, you know, as it is now. I think the person who really brought the Orient to this country was D.T. Suzuki, and that wasn't until the 60s. So his unconscious is really anticipating that.
So he could have written the Tao of Physics back in the 50s?
That's another good question. After I get this understood, I want to go back and compare what he is doing with what is being done today. I think this is light years deeper than the Tao of Physics.
Hmm.
But I couldn't give you a reason. Just my stomach says, this is the real stuff and all that other stuff is air.
In what physics?
The Tao of Physics, the sort of pop,
yeah.
The pop comparison of psychology and physics. Mm-hmm. But I say that a little incautiously, and I'd like to be able to substantiate that. But interesting. Did some of you know Louise Mati? Yeah. Speaking of Buddhism, I was over to visit her a year or so ago, and I walked into the family's house, which is enormous. You know, it's enormous. It's on the National Historic Register. And she's a colleague in Illinois. She's spoken here before. And there's this huge Shinto shrine in the front of the house. And I said, where is that from? And she said, oh, D.T. Suzuki gave that to my grandfather. I said, how did your grandfather know D.T. Suzuki? Oh, he's the one that brought D.T. Suzuki to the States. So her family really brought Buddhism to the States for the first time.
They were the only publishers for a long time.
Were they? Publishing this kind of stuff, yeah. So she really played a role in that. Her family played a role in this whole movement towards the blending of East and West and physics and psychology and religion and science, which is going to show up in his dreams. And the beauty of it is, now taking what we're learning here to this instance, you really see how the unconscious, when the individual has guts and can cook, starts solving, at least in image form, the problems that are ailing us. And it does so in ways you would never think of. And that's the creative dimension of the unconscious. Okay, we left off at 242. I think I'll reread what we stopped with, just to prime the pump a little bit, and to emphasize what you know, but probably we can't say it too much. On 242, the first, second paragraph, sorry, the second paragraph, on closer examination. On closer examination, this is really a tremendous thought. The wisdom of God in the Bible was the playmate of Yahweh. Now that should all sound familiar, right? That's from Proverbs. Who was with him before the beginning of the world. In patristic literature, she was, as we have mentioned, defined as the archetypal world, the mundus archetypus, typus, or as the sum of the eternal ideas in the mind of God, the prototypes from which he created all things. She may also be compared with the Indian Shakti or Maya and with the Gnostic Sophia. This is the important sentence, which we've stressed, and she's just reiterating it. And yet, in our text, this figure is equated with the soul of the dark earth, the impure prima materia. So the religious experience begins in an impure earthly form. That's what is unique about Sophia. Alchemy accordingly lays upon man the task and confers upon him the dignity of rescuing the hidden feminine aspect of God from imprisonment in matter by his opus, and of reuniting her with the manifest masculine deity. Now, in our dream example, soul of the dark earth would be Peter Strohm. That would be the new attitude that was embedded in his anxiety, and I would take anxiety and depression as one of those instances of the dark earth. Anxiety and depression, sexuality we talked about, aggression we talked about, there are probably some others, but some heavy experience that weights you down. And in light of conventional estimations of right, wrong, and success, it's wrong. But that's the very starting point. And the danger is that the collective morality of what is successful, what successful people do, successful people don't get depressed. Successful people are up. Good Christians don't get depressed. Good Christians believe in Christ. Good Christians don't have lust for their neighbor's spouse. They're content in the Lord, all that.
Are you describing this as perfect?
As some version of perfect. As a collective estimation of perfect, Christendom's estimation of perfect. And really, I think the industrial world's estimation of perfect. You know, the less sand you have in your cogs, the better you are as an employee. But all this stuff messes with you. And it lames efficiency. It brings you desires that are difficult. And it puts you in funks that discombobulate and so on, but this is the starting point. Okay, let's then wrap up the chapter on page 243. She's just summarizing. And she sums up the whole chapter here in that very last paragraph, which I'll just read you. Summing up, we may say that the first parable describes an essentially new psychic event, the sudden emergence of wisdom from below, from matter. We've said infinitum, not infinitum. And her demand for succor through man's work and efforts. Not only would she thereby regain her former sublime status, but the final redemption of humanity would also be made possible. Wisdom appears further in the form of a male judge, who is psychologically the embodiment of a tendency in the unconscious to force the conscious mind to make sharper distinctions. Discrimination, presumably between ego and self, personal and impersonal, has become urgently necessary because of the previous contamination of the author's personality with the archetypal anima image. Therefore, the parable ends with a didactic admonition for a ninefold purification of the pearls. Whereas anima wisdom speaks in the middle of the parable, the author himself speaks again at the end. Evidently, the differentiation has been temporarily successful, but it is not definitive, for it is again the anima speaking at the beginning of the next parable. Does that all sound familiar? So we have a start of an experience, but then it gets truncated. Because it's overwhelming, he judges it. That judging is both good and bad, but the effect, because he has to discriminate what he's going through. But the effect of the way he judges is that it becomes collective and moral again. Okay, we go over to the next chapter. Any questions on that? I think it should be clear, I hope. Well, it's the same thing all over again, with some twists. Each of these chapters now will be a return to the beginning and an attempt to get it through to the end. And there will be twists and turns that are similar in each chapter and that are different in each chapter. The title, of the floodwaters of death, which the woman both brought into the world and put to flight. It's there in the second line. As we'll be seeing, the woman is again wisdom. This is not all that important, but it's worth noting. In commenting on the previous chapter, we had deduced only indirectly that wisdom or her descent to the adept was the cause of the negredo. We assumed that's why there was a flood, but here we're told specifically. Not that important. It was not stated directly in the text. The situation of distress in which both found themselves was simply there all of a sudden. The author's attempts at discrimination in the last chapter seem, however, to have given him an inkling that it was wisdom herself who brought about this death. And then she says in the next sentence, paragraph, what I just said to you, that each parable is an abbreviated form of the opus. Next passage, too. It's more of the same. When the multitude of the sea shall be converted to me, and the streams have flowed over my face. We've got a flood. And it's not caused by a cloud descending, but it's caused by her directly. That's about the only really new point. To put it in your own words, she calls, for example, the flood, an inrush of pagan psychic contents. See where I am there? 6 lines down. An inrush of pagan psychic. You want to try to put that in your own words? What is an inrush of pagan psychic contents? Or, in other words, put in your own words what the flood is.
Instinctual affect?
Yeah. Overwhelming.
Well, yeah.
Overwhelming instinctual affect.
All that's been denied and repressed, or...
All that's been denied and repressed.
Held back by the floodgate.
That's been held back, right. Yeah. And generally, a pagan meaning...
All that is a Christian?
Yeah. Well, yeah. That all that doesn't seem moral to us, right? And that idea is expressed there on the 245. See where the quote is? The arrows go up 5 lines. The key there is its overwhelming power.
Catholic girl, I was taught that pagans equals evil.
Yeah.
And they were just interchanged as one of the same.
Yeah.
That's also projection, too, because the Catholicism, took over some of the pagan holidays and
absolutely.
Some of the pagan deities,
and
so
things.
But it had to demonize the other.
Exactly. It's how they were able to incorporate Christianity into the minds of these people. They just reframed their own symbols.
Mm-hmm.
Built their churches on top of their altars.
Mm-hmm.
Took over the grottos. I read somewhere that the grotto of St. Bernadette was a grotto to Aphrodite.
I could imagine, yeah. I think many of them were. Yeah.
There's something else when I was reading this.
Yeah.
Just a little above that, mm-hmm. The ancient authors pointed out that in lead, a prima materia, they dwelt a daemon who could induce mania.
Mm-hmm.
And this is talking about that emotional, instinctual, overwhelming affect.
Yeah.
Well, but it is interesting, though. We've got
lead problems in a literal sense. Mm. It's interesting that in a symbolic way they're talking about this mania, but literally lead poisoning leads to brain dysfunction and mm-hmm. and all kinds of diseases, including some sort of mania.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly. And we've got a big problem with that in Indiana, just like that. But, so that even though they use these symbolic...
It's amazing how the symbols have become real.
It's based in fact. Mm-hmm. So they were onto something. Mm-hmm.
Next passage. The arrows of my quiver are drunk with blood. And what we're looking at there is that theme of the butchery. In her interpretation at the bottom of 245, she refers to the treacherous murder in the Turba. Turba is an alchemical text, and I don't have access to that. But I did find such a picture from another alchemical text, just to pass this around. Where the beginning of the alchemical process is depicted as a murder. So the snake's going to kill her, and she's going to kill the snake in that picture. What's that about? What's that murder? And why is she so vengeful?
Pardon?
And why is she so vengeful? You know the picture of Kali. Their sword and blood and heads.
Necklace of skulls.
Necklace of skulls, yes.
Well, she's an essential beginning. She's what thrusts you into the process. She comes in to destroy it.
Yeah. Well, what's she destroying?
Ego.
Yeah, right. So this process is all often accompanied by images of the destructive feminine, and what it's doing is simply destroying the old ego position. And what would that be in Thomas's world?
Christianity.
Yeah. Well, certainly the old interpretation of Christianity. Right. Right. Yeah. So that's what that's about.
Part of the Mary that's been cut off, and now she's coming back to
come. Right, right, okay. Right.
So did you say the destruction of the feminine was then the destruction of the ego?
Well, yeah, not the the destruction by the feminine.
By the feminine.
Is the destruction.
Even though the dragon killed feminine first in this picture.
Well, they do a job on each other.
Okay.
Meaning that the unconscious turns negative and lames the ego. And in the ego, in letting itself be killed, actually kills the hostile intent of the unconscious. So both are transformed.
Hmm. So we really ascribe a hostile intent to the unconscious?
Well, it certainly feels that way.
To the ego, okay.
To the ego, yeah.
Okay.
And I think you, of course, what we try to do in our work is help the person die psychologically. And I think you can see where the person can't die psychologically. Sometimes they literally die physically. So there it really seems like it's hostile. Hmm.
Like the thing back there when it said love has to die, a certain love. I read that and I had to think.
Do you remember where that was?
Well, that was close to the first part, and I can't remember. But
on
then
246, it says love is something that both kills and makes to live.
Is that what you were thinking of, Mary?
Well, I just remember that. You know, it took a while for me to get that into my head, what they were talking about.
On the top of 246, six or seven down, love kills that which we were,
uh-huh.
in order that we may be that which we were not.
love makes as yeah. were a death for us.
Mm-hmm. That's beautiful. That's a beautiful thing to it.
And ultimately, don't we have to surrender to that dragon?
Yeah.
So when you're confronted with that, killed or be killed type thing, so it's kind of so on the arm with the spirit of the shark that
you guys remember that? Yeah.
A long time ago. Still has no answer with that, so it's kind of that.
It takes a while.
Yeah.
Sometimes it takes a while. Death is slow. And the key thing is that you continually watch in yourself what needs to die. And let it die, generally not without a fight. And then you can also watch the counter reaction, because we're going to see a shift in the text here pretty soon, that follows on that death.
It's important to remember once again that we're looking at this, and we talked about this before, but like with Polly and everybody, we have all of this now in our consciousness as we find ourselves in these spaces in ways that they didn't. I mean, he was just at the beginning of all of that. So he went to sit down and say, you're examples of all these things. You know, I think about what these people...
Yeah, certainly Thomas had no way.
Right.
I think Polly did. He had two very good people trying to help him, and he didn't.
But right, but he also didn't have the... now we know all. We know people are friends, and we know it's like it's more in our... It's still suffering, but I don't know. I guess I just don't fault anybody who doesn't make that choice. Especially early on. It's just so hard to...
Unfortunately, his unconscious does fault him.
Well, damn, his unconscious.
Well, he's dead. this is a question, how much can a person take? And what is so weird that by being kind, you would have helped kill him. That's what's so rough. When the negative thing comes up, and you as a therapist, try to mitigate that, you rob them of the chance of dying psychologically. And then maybe they die physically.
Is that what reductionism? Of the way they would handle it? Trying to mitigate rather than having them go through the whole thing?
They might. I just don't know about that.
What was the danger of pathologizing that behavior and trying to treat that?
Right. Yeah. Because it's so... this is where you have to have the surgeon's coldness. To let them be at the mercy of that inner violence. Because that's the only way that violence will end up not being physically destructive.
The Great Mother. And I think that's the Great Mother who knows this is an initiation to something right. greater, and you need to not try to pull them out of that.
Yeah.
They need to be in them.
Yeah.
The Good Mother would be doing everything.
The Good Mother would be doing everything to
make everything okay.
To make everything okay.
And the
yeah.
Great Mother would just say, I'll hold your hand, but
you have to die.
Do this alone.
Yeah.
And that's what's so dangerous about falling into pity for people.
Absolutely.
This is crucial. Yeah, Nietzsche was big on that kind of false pity.
Yeah. I heard a lecture once, I don't know if I mentioned this or not, I did stop me. I was at a conference and this one of these neo-Jungian types gave a lecture on the importance of love in therapy.
What?
The importance of love in therapy. He was oh so sensitive. And he talked about Paracelsus. Paracelsus was an alchemist. He was Jung's favorite alchemist. And it was really sickening. And at the end of the talk, one of my favorite Jungians, Anne McGuire in London, raised her hand. She said, "You've just lectured us for an hour and a half on Paracelsus and love. Are you aware that Paracelsus was a man filled with hate? Are you aware the most important quality of a therapist is not the way they love, but the way they hate?
That's Kali right there.
That's Kali. You see, that's somebody who has the strength to let people suffer through that dark stuff. Yeah.
Her slogan is the goddess of fierce compassion, and it would be that kind
fierce
of
fierce compassion. Compassion. Yeah, is that that's her slogan, huh?
Well,
yeah,
it's one of many.
I hadn't heard that, but that's wonderful. Okay, so you see what we're dealing with here. And can you feel how the heat's getting turned up a little bit here? Now, this next part, I think, is difficult. I'm going to try to keep its essence, but not get lost in all the details to convey to you what's at stake. So, top of 247. And my presses are fragrant with the best wine, and my barns are filled with the corn of wheat, and the bridegroom with the 10 wise virgins hath entered into my chamber, and therefore my belly hath swelled from the touch of my beloved, and the bolt of my door hath been opened to my beloved. Now, what's the first thing you notice in comparing this passage with the last passage?
Lovely.
Yeah.
I mean, it creates a scene of that one would want to enter.
Why does it follow on the poison arrows? Yes, I would say it is a balance, but can you delineate the link a little more clearly?
Is it a conjunctio experience? Mm-hmm.
Or Phoenix right now, the ashes type.
Kind of, but it's such an obvious link that you're not seeing it. Mm-hmm. The arrows are an impregnation.
Oh. Wow. Drenched in blood? Could have...
That's the amazing thing about this text, that is such a negative image of violence. But that violence is actually a fertilization. Yeah. See, for the conscious, that's what I was getting at. For the consciousness, those arrows are dead. But for the unconscious, they're an impregnation. That's why it is so important to not soften their difficult nature.
Wow.
Maybe I should close the door before they think.
Yeah, before the devil was
drunken arrows.
Blood.
Important to not soften their what nature?
Well, painful, terrible, destructive.
There's something that kind of reminds me of when people are feeling or crying, and just allowing them to be in that and knowing. I had one episode when I reached out and actually touched the teacher, put my hand away and broke. You know, I was a little embarrassed. I was right in front of the class. But she explained to me after that when I went to touch to console, I thought it was consoling, but it stopped her from feeling. And it was because I hadn't gone, you know, I mean, I couldn't handle the emotion she was going through, you know. So you're really honoring somebody when they're in that emotion just by being there with them and allowing them to feel that.
Well, like you just want to say, everyone has a right to their depression.
Right. Just, and now it's almost encouraging, you know, when you see somebody, you know they're kind of on that, there's a possibility of them breaking through.
Yeah.
For me, anyway, even in my own life, too.
Mm-hmm. So that's what she says. If you go down there's the quote, and there's a small paragraph, and then go down 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. The impregnation of the woman. It is as though the bloodbath had the reactive effect of making the woman pregnant by the heavenly bridegroom. Psychologically, that would mean that the hostile emotional outbreak of the divine element, utterly destroying the world of consciousness, has a deeper significance, and that it makes the anima pregnant and initiates a new birth. That is a further and more comprehensive incarnation of God. that's the main point of that text. There's another subsidiary point, which is also important, but not with the same dramatic effect, and that's this business of the 10 wise virgins.
Were they wise or was half and half?
Well, that's what I'm going to get to.
Okay.
It is worth, you see a little bit farther down, it is worth, everybody see that? It is worth while refreshing, I just love that, refreshing our memories. Oh, yes, I forgot about that. With the actual text, Matthew 25:1-13, and I thought I would read it to you. No, is that right?
25:1-13.
No, I don't have it here. Sorry. This is not a text I want to read you. In that text, there are the kingdom of heaven is likened to 10 virgins which took their lamps and went forth to meet the bridegroom, and 5 of them were wise and 5 of them were foolish. That's the main point. They took no oil with them. I thought of this. It's interesting, too, when you think of Eros and Psyche. Yeah, they weren't supposed to have the lamp, and here you're supposed to have the lamp. Isn't that interesting how a tradition will change? Anyway, in the original story, 5 were smart and 5 weren't smart. In this story, all of them are received. Again, to show that this text is dealing with a moral ambivalence, where the traditional Christian interpretation deals with moral clarity. Doesn't matter whether they're foolish or not.
That's because all can be redeemed, or all are redeemed.
All are redeemed.
Right.
And she goes on that on 248. Just a side point, very, very side point. 248, I just mentioned it, the second paragraph. The fact that it's a group of women waiting for one bridegroom, she says, has to do with the Oriental influence of the text. I don't think it's important for our purposes, but I just mentioned it. But what she says then in the next paragraph, the striking thing in our text is the fact that all 10 virgins enter the bridal chamber with the bridegroom. I'll skip a little bit. This intimation of a more comprehensive redemption in which even the inadequate human being shares is presumably due to the eruption of God's shadow into human psyche.
Hmm.
In other words, that this text starts with the darkness. That's what we've been saying. Just another confirmation of the morally ambivalent nature.
So you're saying, because she said all 10 entered.
Right.
That
the level of transformation that the Sophia experience is talking about doesn't distinguish on the basis of right and wrong.
Okay.
It doesn't say, oh, that's a good and that's a bad experience. Oh, that's a good desire, that's a bad desire.
Mm-hmm.
It starts with the complexity of desire. And from that generates.
So the bloodbath is what they're saying was brought about the impregnation. That's what they're talking about here in that one.
Yeah, the bloodbath brought about the impregnation, and that impregnation and that new development is something that doesn't judge on the old basis of right and wrong.
What's the Phileus Philosophorum?
Phileus Philosophorum is the end state, the Philosopher's Stone.
Wait a minute.
Phileus is son. Philosophorum is philosophers, and it means the son of the philosophers. But the son of the philosophers is a name given for the stone that the philosophers make.
Okay.
And the philosophers are the alchemists.
Is that the Lapidus? No.
Lapis, yeah. So you see it both ways, lapis philosophorum and and Phileas left for the support. Son of, meaning they produce it.
Okay. Is this inclusion of the five unwise virgins speak to our inclusion of our shadow? In our
That is the inclusion of the shadow. Yeah. Right. This starts with the shadow, and it integrates the shadow into the new whole. And the spiritual experience starts with what was cast out.
Back to that term of Phileas philosophy, Fordham made a note there that says that for the psychological, it's again used the soul's pregnancy, it's the psychology of transference. But I mean, that's what we're talking about here, this soul's pregnancy as a result of the blood-drenched arrows, leading to a resolution here, well, a birth of a new orientation. Okay. That's
Gary, we're, as far as when they're talking about the scripture here, where it says, you know, Lord, open to us, and he says, verily I send to you, I know you not. So where is that coming from? What does that mean?
Where's that?
248, the top of that. That says, verily I send to you, I know you not, watch therefore, you know neither the day nor the hour. So what is that in? What is that talking about?
Yeah, see, I'm trying to get the context.
That's about the five that went to go get oil, and then the bridegroom already came, and the door was shut. So then they're trying to call, and then...
Yeah.
What is that saying symbolic, or what is that?
That if you got a shadow, you're in trouble. I don't accept you having a shadow.
So that's ego saying that, or was that?
I think it's Lord, it's God saying that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So there was a point where God doesn't accept the shadow?
Hello. Has he ever?
That's what he's learning.
He's
embracing. He's what?
Yeah, in the Old Testament, he... he's a criminal. But he wants everyone else to be moral. And in the New Testament, he's prissy. And nobody can have a shadow. Sorry, am I offending you?
No.
Nobody got a shadow. And what this text is showing us is how do we get an understanding of God and of ourselves that not only accepts the dark stuff, but sees it as the way to God. That's the fundamental shift.
So we're helping God. I mean, I know it sounds really naive, but we're helping God embrace the dark side.
I don't think it sounds naive. I think that's exactly what Jung would understand. That if we can go through these experiences, let me back up a second. Remember in the dream how he was worried about the nature of God's personality before that. So you could see that Peter Strom was a response to his anxiety about the nature of God. Mm-hmm. So it's trying to help him develop a new understanding of God. And we don't know what the long-term effects of this will be. But for Jung's money, this is something that has to happen in individuals before it can happen in any.
So you just kind of connected. Sense. You just connected for me, and now it sounded like, you know, he just had that split where you know stuff, but as far as I've been getting that verse for a long, long time, and now that makes sense. That makes sense because of me integrating the shadow self. Or coming.
You've got to realize what a destructive effect the church has had on the shadow.
Right, but even in my own self, rejecting that. You know what I mean?
Well, you probably interjected the church.
Right. So that's where, yeah, it's all coming in. I mean, that's where I may just have clarification of what that means right now. So
I say, lousy parents, give me half my income, the church gives me the other half. Mm-hmm. I spent half my time helping people over this very problem right here. It's vicious. Let me see.
Interesting.
get the first extra time, it's essential. So, I mean, that's perfect. We're right where we need to be. In other words, we're now going back and reclaiming that part that we cast off, but we wouldn't have known we cast it off if we hadn't done it. It's almost like we had to gain that consciousness around it first.
So for us,
I can't disagree with you, but the cost of it today is just... I mean, think of the murder in the world today. Most of it is done around people with conflicting images of God. That's scary. You don't see Buddhists out there killing people. You see Jews and Christians killing people. And Muslims. Yeah.
Well, I think, too,
I mean,
they're supposed to have the same
image. Isn't that ironic?
Well, yeah, they're from the same family.
Really, from the same
family tree.
Yeah.
We're cousins.
Well, I think even a lot of us getting it from the head into the actual body. You know, I mean, for me, I think a lot of it's just been head knowledge. Now it's just getting it to where it's integrating it. Yeah.
Let me follow up here with one thing, and we'll take a break. 248. The inundation and the bloodbath, bottom of 248, kind of repeating what we've said, simultaneously brought about an impregnation. Okay, that's what we've said, right? Which will result in the birth of the phileus filiciform. Now, that phileus filiciform, you know, you can take on many different levels. Peter Strom was a phileus filiciform. On the individual level, it would be your new path, your new self, your new confidence, all the way up to the social, social may not be the best word, but the social level, the community level of a new image of God. Pauli was trying to produce a new value in himself, and on a wider scale, the collective unconscious is trying to get us to produce a new value for our time, symbolized by the image of God. Looking back, we can see that the flood and the cloud in the previous and preceding parable have acquired a new aspect. Very important. They are not only destructive, but fertilizing factors. That's probably the most important sentence so far. Down a little farther, just as in the last parable, almost to the next quote, 1, 2, 3, 4 lines up from the first quote there on 249. Just as in the last parable, the flood had the double aspect of a deadly inundation and purifying ablution, indicated at the end by the albedo. The albedo would be the whiteness, right? So here have the flood and the negredo. They kill and quicken at once. There's no time to stop. Let's take a break.